Today I have the pleasure of introducing Ken Cameron. He's a new professor at UW-Madison. He's in the botany department. He's also the director of the herbarium. Ken did his PhD at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with Mark Chase and William Dickinson. And the title of his PhD was Phylogenetic Relationships of the Vanilloid Orchids, an Integration of Molecular, Anatomical, and Morphological Data. More recently, he was the director and associate curator of the Molecular Systematics Program at NYBG, the New York Botanical Garden. His research is focused on systematics, evolution, structure, and conservation of orchids, especially of vanilla. Ken has also worked on plant DNA barcoding and a number of other plant families, including Smilacaceae, Malpighiaceae, Cactaceae, Droseraceae, and Lentibulariaceae. He's been collecting in Mexico, New Zealand, Australia, New Caledonia, Vanuatu, Fiji, Sarawak, and Sabah, Borneo, East and West Malaysia, China, Gabon, Ecuador, and Uruguay.
And most recently, Alabama, last week.
All exotic. He's published a number of popular articles and has been featured in the Science Times, PBS, BBC, and Gourmet magazine. Ken's title today is The Orchids Have Been a Splendid Sport, Evolutionary Studies Within the Largest Family of Plants from Darwin's Time to the Present. Thank you, Ken.
Thanks. Well, thank you. I'm not such a new professor anymore, having been here now more than 1 year. It's hard to believe how quickly time passes. But I've had a wonderful first year and have met many of you. Those that I have not had a chance, I look forward this year to getting to know my colleagues a little bit better. As you can imagine, it's been quite a whirlwind past 12 months. But I am over in Birch Hall in the herbarium and would welcome talking to anyone, students or faculty on campus. So as Andy mentioned, I intend today to return to our theme from last year, which had a very strong Darwin focus. Remember that we are still in the year 2009 and celebrating Darwin's birth, as well as the anniversary of the Origin of Species. I think last year, many of our departments did embrace and celebrate that fact. And I would like to keep the party going because we are still celebrating Chuck, his birthday, February 12th, 1809. And you know, we focused a lot on his zoological contributions, his contributions to the theory of evolution by natural selection, and I'd like to shift gears by talking about his botanical background, and in particular, his fascination with orchids, which he called a splendid sport. So as an orchidologist, I guess I can call myself a jock, which I never thought I could before. Now, I don't know about you, but if I were celebrating a big birthday milestone like this, I would have a little bit of a happier smile on my face, maybe. So I hope he doesn't mind, but I've decided to dress him up just a little bit, and I don't think he would mind, because this man was remarkable, and his contributions to orchidology are really superior. So, as I said, he commented on the fact that he studied orchids and called them a splendid sport, but he also provided us with a number of other wonderful quotations. This is a year of Darwin quotations, right? So he said, "You cannot conceive how the orchids have delighted me. I am sillily and very idly interested in them. The orchids are more play than real work, but this subject is a passion with me." So clearly this man had a fondness for at least these particular flowering plants. But you may be sitting there in the room scratching your head and thinking, wait a minute, why is Ken talking about plants and orchids? I thought Charles Darwin was a zoologist who studied birds and tortoises and iguanas and barnacles. Well, in fact, Charles Darwin's passion for nature started, as you know, at a very early age. But even on his formulative voyage of the Beagle around the world, he was collecting plants and documenting plant diversity and developing his theories not only based on the animals he observed, but on the plant life as well. For example, this is an actual herbarium specimen collected by Charles Darwin. It's Gavalea patagonica from South Chile. And what's really interesting about this particular specimen is that Darwin himself sketched the flower and attached that to the specimen. This is one of the very few illustrations we actually have that Darwin did in his own hand. He obviously had professional artists to do most of his illustrations for him. And comparing his sketch to the real thing is, you know, it's not so bad. So he was clearly interested in orchids even at a very early age. And I just wanted to spend one moment looking at a quote from the Voyage of the Beagle, not focused on birds or tortoises, but on plants. I won't read the whole thing, but he did turn to the flora of the Galapagos Islands, for example, and commented on the genus Scalesia, which he said was a remarkable arborescent genus of the Compositae, confined to that archipelago, went on to describe it, and then said that the species of the Compositae are particularly local in the Galapagos. In like manner, we have seen that the different islands have their proper species of the mundane genus of tortoise and the widely distributed American genus of the mocking thrush, as well as of two of the Galapagian subgroups of finches. So his examples of evolution and basically island biogeography were not restricted to animals. They certainly embraced the flora of these lands. And I think it's unfortunate that that's sort of been glossed over and forgotten by people today as the more charismatic, you know, animal examples have come to the forefront. So Charles Darwin, I would say, was a botanist. We can call him such. And I say that not only for the previous reason, but also the fact that he published no fewer than 7 books, not just papers, but actual books, focused on exclusively botanical, or almost entirely botanical subjects. For example, The Power of Movement in Plants, an entire volume devoted to insectivorous plants, plant domestication, for example. What we're here today to discuss is Charles Darwin's contributions to orchidology. And as you see, in 1862, he wrote a book called The Various Contrivances by Which Orchids Are Fertilized by Insects. The fact that this book was published immediately after The Origin of Species is significant, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Notice that is the following book that he published after The Origin. And if you're interested in more details concerning Charles Darwin's botanical works, I encourage you to come over to Burge Hall, because this year the herbarium is featuring, we've pulled objects from our collection to profile Charles Darwin's different contributions to botany, and we intend to have this exhibit up in the lobby through the year, and then we'll probably rotate it out in January. So please come over and take a look at that. Okay, so let's return then to the orchid book. Now, as I said, if you pick up a copy today, it will probably go by the title The Various Contrivances by Which Orchids Are Fertilized by Insects, 1862. The book originally contained 300 pages and 35 illustrations. In fact, the proper title of the book includes the by which British and foreign orchids are fertilized by insects. And I just point that out because in the first edition, Darwin treated 63 different genera. But the book was very popular. It actually sold out, to his surprise, actually. And in 1885, they published the second edition that actually included 85 different genera as people around the world started sending Darwin samples from Australia, North America, and other continents. So it's actually a fascinating book for an orchid taxonomist to see the exposure to some of these tropical genera that hadn't been seen by Europeans before. Now, if you look at any of Darwin's works, you know, they always have a prominent title on The Origin of Species. I actually find the subtitles to be much more interesting and in many ways I think more informative. I almost get the impression that the editors, you know, decided what the titles were and then Darwin actually subtitled them what he secretly desired. And the subtitle of this book is And on the Good Effects of Intercrossing. And this is important, especially the fact that this book followed The Origin of Species. Darwin was actually gathering information much earlier than 1862 on orchids, but in response to critics of The Origin, he quickly pulled all that data together and put this book out to specifically to address this problem of intercrossing and outcrossing and sexual recombination. I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, here's where I step back for a minute, and I hope no one has Rotten Tomatoes. I'm going to play, or I'm actually going to present what armchair psychologists have said is significant about this subtitle. And that is the fact that they say Charles Darwin had a personal interest with inbreeding and outcrossing. Because of the fact that the Darwin and the Wedgwood families had intermarried for many generations. And yes, in fact, this is the Wedgwood family of Wedgwood China fame that's still being produced today, a very wealthy, prominent family. Of the 62 aunts, uncles, and cousins born in the four generations founded by Darwin's grandparents, 38, or 61% of those, remained childless. And more specifically, a total of 19, or 73%, of the 26 children born from the first cousin marriages in this Darwin family did not reproduce. Now, you might say, now this was long ago, they didn't have sophisticated health care, but these were wealthy families. They didn't need a public option for health care. and so we might speculate, I don't think this has ever been proven, but we might speculate that it is due to this inbreeding between these two families that we saw a reduction in fitness of the Darwin families. In fact, Charles Darwin himself married his first cousin, Emma Wedgwood, and several of their children died young, three of the 10, or suffered serious health problems. In fact, only three of their seven living children produced grandchildren for the Darwins. So, you know, I think what this says is something we all know, that our own personal backgrounds and our private lives probably influence our thinking and our research and our public lives as well. And again, armchair psychologists have argued that this fact might have contributed to Darwin developing his theory. In fact, within the orchid book of Darwin, he stated, "It is hardly an exaggeration to say that nature tells us in the most emphatic manner that she abhors perpetual self-fertilization." And he went on to document that through this unique family of plants. He said, "Unless we bear in mind the good effects which have proved to follow in most cases from cross-fertilization, it is astonishing that the flowers of orchids should not have been regularly self-fertilized. It apparently demonstrates that there must be something injurious in this latter process, of which I have elsewhere given direct proof." So example after example of how orchids, for lack of a better word, go out of their way to avoid selfing. Now, why did he choose orchids? Why didn't he just pick another group of flowering plants? Well, one possibility is that the orchid flower, this complex structure, to the non-scientist would appear to be the perfect plant for selfing. And the reason I say that is, in contrast to a more typical flowering plant like this lily, where the stamens and the pistil are free or separated from one another, in the typical orchid flower, the male reproductive organs have been reduced to one single fertile stamen, and that stamen has been fused almost entirely with the female pistil. And you can see here the anther at the apex, and this would be the stigmatic surface. This is a longitudinal section through a vanilla flower. Now, what people in general don't realize is that most orchids have developed complex mechanisms to avoid selfing, and that's what Darwin was documenting. In this particular case, the vanilla flower actually develops a special membrane-like structure here called the rostellum that physically separates the anther from the stigma. So it would be very difficult for that flower to self. Nevertheless, it's a bisexual unit fused together. At that time, naturalists assumed that most of these flowers were selfed and selfing, and that they were not outcrossing, as we know better today. So that's an example in orchids of a mechanical barrier, but of course, the close relationship between insects and orchid flowers has been well documented. And this particular case, this is from Darwin's book, Here's the Real Thing. Even the exact positioning of the pollinia on the insect proboscis or its body is often a very close one-to-one match between flower and pollinator. So these flowers at the time appeared to be, you know, perfectly designed. They're you know, the hand of God. And so Darwin went about addressing his critics with this question of, is this evolution by the hand of a creator, these remarkably well-designed flowers, or is this natural selection? And again, I hope you don't mind me pulling out all these quotes. I just find them so interesting. The famous North American botanist Asa Gray, who was a very good friend of Darwin's, they corresponded regularly, stated that if the orchid book, with a few trifling omissions, had appeared before The Origin, the author would have been canonized rather than anathematized by natural theologians. He was giving examples of what appeared to be intelligent design, perfection in design and structure. But Darwin saw it differently. He said to his publisher, John Murray, "I think this little volume will do good to The Origin, as it will show that I have worked hard at details." That was one of the criticisms. You haven't provided us enough details of your theory. So that's one of the sort of highlights of the orchid book. And he did, in fact, provide details, many details. The one that's probably most famous and referenced most often has to do with what's often called Darwin's comet orchid or Star of Bethlehem orchid, Angraecum sesquipedale, endemic to Madagascar. You can see the flower here. With this very long and prominent nectar spur containing nectar at the base. In fact, sesquipedale means a foot and a half. So this is a long this is a long nectar spur. So Darwin, you know, this is before genetics were fully understood and so forth. He speculated on the origin of that nectar spur. We can thus understand how the astonishing length of the nectary had been acquired by successive modifications. As certain moths of Madagascar became larger through natural selection in relation to their general condition of life, those individual plants of the Angraecum, which had the longest nectaries, and there's a whole chapter on nectar spur variation, would be best fertilized. These plants would yield the most seed, and the seedlings would generally inherit long nectaries. And so it would be in successive generations of the plant and the moth. So an example, then. What was really fascinating about this is that no such moth was known at the time. This was pure speculation on Darwin's part, and it actually was not until 1903 that the moth was discovered. And here's an example of it with its proboscis fully extended. And it's really quite remarkable. And the fact that Darwin predicted it was immortalized in the specific epithet of the moth. So what I'd like to do with the remaining time I have is give some more modern examples of orchid biology research. And even this example, the pollination of the Angraecum orchid, has been receiving attention in just the past few years. Most remarkably, the question of whether or not this moth, in fact, does visit and pollinate the orchid has been addressed. So with all respect to YouTube and bootlegging, I have a little
bit of... Another infamous rainforest creature. Phil DeVries has come from the University of New Orleans in search of an animal that is legendary in the annals of jungle exploration. It all began back in 1862, in this small office in the south of England. It was here that Charles Darwin first examined an unusual flower that had everyone baffled. An orchid from Madagascar that seemed to defy the laws of nature. This flower hid its nectar at the bottom of a long, narrow tube. It seemed inconceivable that any insect could ever reach it. But Darwin famously predicted that somewhere in Madagascar, there must be a gigantic moth with a tongue 12 inches long. Darwin's peers ridiculed him for his prediction. But 150 years later, Phil has rediscovered the famous comet orchid high in a tree. And now he hopes to show that Darwin was right after all.
This is what Darwin was all excited about. Look at the size of that nectar. The moth has to have a proboscis that long to insert into there, the beginning of the flower, the opening, down this tremendously long nectar spur, just to get the reward, which is right at the bottom of that.
The question is, will the strange flower act as bait to attract the world's most remarkable moth? Up in the tree, he rigs an infrared camera. If the moth appears, it will be in the dead of night. But Phil's camera can film in total darkness using infrared light invisible to the moth. There are no guarantees. Only 10% of Madagascar's original rainforest remains. This jungle is so disturbed that from one year to the next, no one can be sure that the moth still exists. After dark, the flower acts like a beacon, releasing a trail of scent through the forest. The infrared light is turned on. The flower in the tree and Phil on the ground are bathed in a light visible only to our cameras. Now, all he has to do is wait. And wait.
I can't move this leg. It's dying.
But 8 hours into his stakeout, 142 years, 7 months, and 5 days after Darwin's prediction, all his efforts are about to pay off.
Oh, there it is. It's hovering in front of the orchid. There it is. Look at the tongue's coming out, man. Amazing. Look at that.
So, pretty cool, huh? Even today, 150 years later, following on Darwin's initial hypothesis, I'll just continue to be fascinated by orchids and so many different aspects. So, as I've been saying the last few minutes, much of this book is focused on pollination, and in particular, floral structures that affect pollination or prevent inbreeding. I and many of my colleagues in the last few years have begun to question the value of floral features exclusively in terms of understanding orchid phylogeny and especially in terms of classification. In a family with more than 25,000 species and such spectacular and outrageous flowers, of course most of the research has been focused on floral structures and floral morphology. But I've begun to question whether that always makes the most sense. For example, consider these 6 different orchids. In fact, they're all different genera, and they span the phylogeny of the orchid family so much so that they actually represent different subfamilies. And yet, to most who are not familiar with orchid structures, you might consider those all closely related, just based on this common floral form, this convergence. And in fact, it's this convergence of floral features, which makes sense when you think about a family so interwoven with its insect pollinator, that has perhaps been misleading us for several decades in terms of understanding relationships and classification. So in the past several years, I myself and my students have been somewhat focusing on this question: what is the value of non-floral structures and characters in reconstructing orchid phylogeny and understanding evolution within this, perhaps the largest family of plants on Earth? So what I'd like to do is give you three examples of my own research, some published, some not quite yet, and that is the genus Malaxis, the genus Spiranthes, and the genus Vanilla. So let's start first with Malaxis. This genus of orchids is a member of a tribe called Malaxidae, which in its basic sense consists of three genera: Malaxis, Oberonia, and Liparis. Oberonia is very distinctive. It's old world tropics, very distinctive vegetative growth. So its classification has never really been doubted. But Malaxis and Liparis, sometimes called the tway blade orchids because they have two leaves, tway blades, have generally been segregated, and there's hundreds of species. I think somewhere more than 500 species in this group. Have generally been segregated from one another based on two major characteristics. Is the flower oriented such that the lip or the labellum is downward, as typical for most orchids, which actually results in is the result of a 180 degree twisting of the ovary to provide that orientation, and also a very long and slender column, in contrast to flowers that to us appear upside down, where the lip or the labellum is upright and the column is relatively short and fat. That's been the main character that separated those two genera. When I sequenced a couple of genes and reconstructed the phylogeny of this group a few years ago, lo and behold, neither Malaxis nor Liparis were strictly monophyletic. In fact, you can see Liparis species distributed throughout the cladogram here. So that had me scratching my head until I looked more carefully at non-floral structures, in particular leaf morphology, and noticed that there was an almost perfect correlation between leaf form, not flowers, and the phylogeny of this particular group. So those species that have either a single or a pair of leaves that's folded only once with a major, the significant mid-vein, form a clade. These that are multi-pleated and folded or plicate formed another major group, and so forth. So the idea that perhaps vegetative morphology could be more useful than floral in this particular group was a novel idea when we consider that since the time of Linnaeus, almost everything has been focused on the flower in terms of classification.
Ken, you've got an epiphyte terrestrial split.
Oh, I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Right here. The other significant split in this phylogeny was the fact that all of the terrestrial species here in blue formed a clade, were derived from a single common ancestor. And so in fact it appears as though this transition, it's actually a secondary reversal back to the terrestrial condition for Orchidaceae, might have been important in driving evolution within this group. Certainly it requires a new classification system, but it got us thinking that maybe transitions from terrestrial to epiphytic habit and vice versa might be important in the orchids. And in fact, one of my grad students and I have been considering the idea that perhaps this was a major key innovation in the orchid family. And I say that because at this particular node of the cladogram, we have a very short branch, although it's highly supported. And that particular node corresponds to an optimization of epiphytism in the orchid family. And we have very poor support for all the rest of the branches, indicating what appears to look like a rapid radiation, especially when we consider the fact that more than 80% of orchid species are epiphytes and belong in this particular clade. So that's the Liparis malaxis group right there, and it just represents one reversal back to the terrestrial condition. But we're considering this hypothesis a little bit more. The second example comes from a genus of orchids most abundant here in North America. This is the genus Spiranthes, which most of you may recognize. The name Spiranthes refers to the coil aspect of the inflorescence. These are often called ladies' tresses, and they've been a very difficult group for taxonomists to work with. More than 462 names are in the literature for this group, and I think that number is grossly inflated. More recent treatments from the flora of North America and other countries look like this, so the species numbers are probably much smaller, but nevertheless you can see that their floral structure is quite similar. In fact, this is a challenging group because of the ephemeral nature of the plants. They are quite rare, or at least some of them are. They're polymorphic, so for example, consider this species, Spiranthes tuberosa. These are just different individuals representing a range of variation. They also hybridize and exhibit polyploidy, and all of these factors, of course, have led to this taxonomic inflation. So this particular group of species is very difficult to work with at the taxonomic level. So we've been throwing molecular data at the problem, and with a four-gene phylogeny so far, we have a tree that's actually quite well resolved and supported. And what I want to point out is the fact that chromosome number, not features of floral morphology, actually correlate very well with this phylogeny. That's not unusual. We find that in many groups of flowering plants. So there's effectively a group with a base chromosome number, the haploid condition of 22 and multiples of that, and another clade based on 15. In our phylogeny, it was curious because that species I showed earlier, Spiranthes tuberosa, fell out between those two major groups and sister to the N equals 15 clade, but there had never been a chromosome count done for Spiranthes tuberosa. So we were scratching our heads thinking, I wonder if it's going to be 15 or 22. So we counted the chromosomes, and to our great surprise, they had a haploid count of 12. And this is significant because it had always been assumed that 22 was a base number and that this clade, these species, were aneuploid derivatives of that, having lost as many as 7 chromosomes. But in fact, it now looks as though within Spiranthes, the base chromosome number is probably 11, and that these are polyploids and then aneuploids of that. So it's really kind of challenged our notion of chromosome rearrangements and evolution in Spiranthes. So again, non-floral characters showing a great importance. And then finally, the genus Vanilla is near and dear to my heart. That's the reason I ended up in Gourmet magazine, and I'm writing a book about vanilla. And I always, I'm famous for saying that there's nothing boring about vanilla. So of course, this genus provides us with the natural flavoring and fragrance vanilla based on the genus Vanilla planifolia. As you can see here, this friend of mine from Mexico, he says, vanilla is in our blood. And he really resents the fact that Madagascar has become the world's largest producer of natural vanilla. Damn it, it's a Mexican plant. in fact, the genus Vanilla, surprising for the fact that it's the only orchid of almost 30,000 species of significant agricultural importance. Of course, the cut floral industry and the ornamental industry is enormous for orchids, but Vanilla planifolia is basically it in terms of crop plants. But there is quite an interesting diversity of species within this genus. There's probably about 100 species in the genus, and you can see some examples of flowers there. Now, clearly in this group, flowers matter. You can see there's a lot of diversity, or at least we think they do. And I've been focusing my research over the last 10 years really on not just the genus Vanilla, but the entire subfamily to to which vanilla belongs. Originally, this orchid had been classified as a somewhat advanced group, and it turns out that actually they represent their own subfamily that is sister to all orchids, except for two little genera down here. So it's a really pivotal group in terms of understanding orchid evolution and biogeography and dating and so forth. So I've been recently acquiring species of vanilla and sequencing DNA. This is the basically unpublished phylogeny for the genus. And it appears as though flowers are not so important, nor is vegetative structures that have been used in the past, primarily leafy and leafless. There are leafless vanillas, and then there are leafy. And that was one of the major ways that botanists in the past had classified them in the subgenera. Instead, it appears as though there's a strong geographic component to the phylogeny. So essentially, most New World species form a clade. There's a few here. And then most Old World species form a clade with a dispersal probably back to the Caribbean New World here. So geography seems to be important. And that got me thinking more then about those vegetative features, the non-floral ones. Specifically questioning the origin of leaflessness within vanilla. So there are about 12 species. As I said, they've once been classified as their own subgenus. Most are adapted to xeric conditions. And surprisingly, I noticed that they're mostly found on islands. In Africa, 5 of the 6 leafless species are Madagascar endemics. And then in the Neotropics, basically all 4 of the leafless species are found in the Caribbean. So one question then is, do these species share a common ancestor, as the old classification implied, or have similar island habitats influenced the evolution of their vegetative morphology, in other words, their loss of leaves? And some work on stem anatomy of the group by other researchers showed that both New and Old World leafless vanillas were monophyletic. They were derived from a common ancestor. Their anatomy is remarkably similar. And yet, the molecular data implies most likely 3 independent losses of leaves within this group. African, Asian, and then this Caribbean group that I mentioned had been dispersed back to the New World. And it's this group that I'm particularly intrigued by because it's, I'm not going to say common, but there are a number of documented cases of otherwise exclusively African lineages of orchids that have made it to the Caribbean, probably by hurricane winds or something like that. And in some cases, they've actually radiated in the Caribbean. Maybe the best example is the famous ghost orchid, which was featured in the movie Adaptation or the book The Orchid Thief. That's a member of what's otherwise an African group that has made its way into the Caribbean. And a really interesting parallel can be made to that group and to the vanilla genus. So Carlsward and others published a phylogeny of this African group, Vandi, and they actually showed that dispersal to the Caribbean also resulted in a loss of leaves in this group. So I'm really intrigued by that and the parallel to vanilla. And I think it's work that needs to be explored more fully. So in conclusion, I'll just go back to Darwin's original quote. The orchids have been a splendid sport. But in fact, Darwin went beyond that. He said, orchids have interested me more than almost anything in my life. And I would have to agree, and for that reason, put Darwin at the center of modern orchidology. And I'm happy to take any questions that you might have. Thank you. Any questions? Yeah.
Were the beneficial effects he found of outcrossing universal? I haven't spread the whole book myself yet.
Within orchids?
Yeah. There are some self-fertilizing orchids, particularly in Europe.
Yeah, sure. And there are a number of orchids that are facultatively selfing, so especially in extreme climates or habitats when pollinators aren't present.
Which is why you're in the escape clause perpetual.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, in the book, Darwin doesn't go the next step and try germinating seeds and growing up plants and measuring fitness in any scientific way. He more documents simply the mechanisms by which selfing is blocked. And as I said, many of those are mechanical issues relating to selfing compatibility and that kind of thing. You know, he didn't have access to the methods, but mostly just documenting the fact that even in this group where you've got organs all fused together and it would seem that as hermaphrodites they would self, or at least that was the notion of the day, they don't. They go out of their way to do anything they can to avoid that.
And among all those passionate breeders, hybrids of course are famous, but people don't develop self-fertilizing lines of orchids.
Right, and actually there's a bit of a misunderstanding about hybridization in the orchid family. It's very rare in nature to find hybrids, for a family that large anyway. In the greenhouse, no problem. Man can do it, but we have to go around those barriers. So the notion that there are big hybrid swarms of orchids out in the wild is actually false for the most part. A lot of the new work on fitness and pollination has been done by South African botanists, especially Steve Hopper and some folks in Australia really led the way and have opened up a whole new area of research. The piece to this puzzle that I haven't talked about is the mycorrhizae and the association of orchids with fungi, which is a requirement for seed germination. So not only do orchids have this intimate relationship with animals, but with fungi as well. So both of those are probably driving selection. And that hasn't really been looked at much at all.
In the Molaxis liberis stories, it looked like there were two instances of the non supination independence.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that right? It looked like it's on the
second. The number of Molaxises that were
yes.
on that? Yeah, okay.
So I was wondering, do they both do it the same way?
Ooh,
in
that's...
terms of whether they don't twist or twist 360?
Oh, you're going to think I planted this question. That's a great question, because Darwin actually illustrated a flower of Molaxis paludosa in his book. And what's remarkable is that orchid doesn't just, it doesn't avoid twisting, it actually twists a full 360. So that its lip being uppermost is a different mechanism than not twisting at all. So now the other clade, I'm not sure. I don't think anyone's really looked at what the degree, I assume they're all probably twisting 360. Degrees as opposed to a lack of twisting, but I don't think anyone's looked at that.
Both happen, I know. I don't think so.
Do they always twist the same direction?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Interesting question. Tom, do you know if that?
Oh, no, I don't know.
Okay. But you were going to ask the question.
I was
okay.
Ask question. One thing would be really interesting to do, I don't think it's ever been done with any group, actually, with orchids. But given the massive adaptive radiation you see in various places and community assembly, it would be very interesting to somehow capture through morphological measurements the morphospace that different floras occupy and see whether there's any predictability to it. In other words, obviously a lot of natural history is interesting stories. And you know, we had some examples today, but we also want to get predictions. And to a certain extent, you know, they just does not just be talking to cat top of taste, cat top of taste of the insects or the animals visiting. But it's sort of interesting to like compare a South African flora with a Southwest Australian flora, or a Eastern U.S. flora, or a Japanese flora, to see whether there is much similarity.
Yeah.
And also the extent to which there's phylogenetic inertia. I mean, obviously, Spirorhynchus is there, like Spirorhynchus here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess Peter Linder and some have done that with other groups of plants, but not with orchids,
right,
to my knowledge. You hear that, graduate students? Great project ideas. Yeah.
I'm intrigued by the specificity between the plant and it's insect pollinators. And I'm wondering, I didn't know much about it, so I'm wondering, is that common among orchids? Do all orchids or most of them have just one or very narrow range of species that pollinate them? Or is it actually some of them?
Both types exist. I mean, there are certainly orchids that are more promiscuous and allowing of different species to visit them. But, I want to say, I think it's probably the norm more than the exception to have that specificity. You know, Tom makes a good point that there's lots of speculation and great natural history stories. Unfortunately, most of the orchid pollination stories are not backed up by actual field observations. There's lots of examples out there. Even the speculation that certain red tubular orchids must be hummingbird pollinated, and yet no one's ever seen a hummingbird visit those flowers. We're just lacking the field data and the observations. So I think I think that's an open area of research. As I said, a lot of new work being done in South Africa and Australia, but the neotropics just have hardly been touched in that regard. Of course, the problem is insect taxonomy is a dying discipline, and being able to identify those pollinators is a real challenge. So I think it's up to us to continue to promote both fields. Evelyn, you had a question.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the diversity, or what you know about those Caribbean and Mexican, how are they pollinated?
Which ones? The
Caribbean?
The Caribbean vanillas?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's ever done a study, presumably bees, but I don't know what type exactly. And of course, it's famous and well known that vanilla planifolia outside of its natural range in Madagascar and Reunion and Tahiti and so forth have to be hand pollinated because their natural insect pollinator isn't present. But presumably some sort of large bee. But the flowers have no fragrance. Incidentally, people often assume that vanilla flowers must smell like vanilla. It's a deceptive pollination strategy. And the flowers actually have sort of a trap mechanism. They're really cool. They have these scale-like bristles that are hinged, and insects can crawl in without much trouble. But as soon as they back up, it's like the rental car place. If you back up, you blow your tires. So the insects really struggle to get out of the flowers. They're pretty neat. Yeah, you have a question.
So I'm curious about this terrestrial versus epiphyte thing, and you gave us one example where it seemed to sort of fall out in the tree, that was a correlated thing, but I'm a little unclear as to whether that was the case more than in that particular instance. And the reason I ask is because I was wondering if anybody's ever looked at, and I know this is kind of a childish way to ask the question, I'm sorry, is it harder to be a fit epiphyte versus being a fit terrestrial? Is it more difficult to achieve a certain fitness level in either one of those states?
In terms of fitness, I mean, it's a challenging environment, and there's a lot of physiological change that has to take place to survive as an epiphyte.
In either case, I don't think.
Yes.
To go from one to the other is pretty...
Certainly, I mean, in terms of anatomy, structure, water retention, photosynthesis, desiccation, so forth, major structural and physiological changes to survive in the epiphytic habit. If you do, then in theory there could be less competition, although we don't see the same kind of rapid radiation in bromeliaceae or other epiphytic lineages. So,
don't you really say that.
you're not going to compare bromeliads to orchids.
Seriously, the orchids go back.
Yeah.
How far?
The age is much longer.
It's much greater, and I mean, basically the bromeliads, which are almost all epiphytes, have largely evolved in the last 4 million years, and they're nearly 1,000 species.
So it's comparing apples to oranges.
It's very, very rapid.
Yeah. So I think that might have something to do with it. Forgot the first part of your question.
Oh, the first part was, did you see that same thing falling out in the other trees as well, this difference, or was it not there?
In terms of the major orchid family optimization, it's pretty clear cut. In terms of the Liparus malaxis example of the reversal back to terrestrialism, I've counted at least 8 cases in the orchid family of that reversal back to a terrestrial condition. Although I have to admit that categorizing something as a true epiphyte or a true terrestrial can be tricky with orchids, because there are a number that they're effectively living, they're on the roadside, let's say. But when you look at what they're growing in, you wouldn't call that soil. It's more of a gravel. They might be kind of a lithophyte, but it's something in between. So it's not always as black and white as it appears. But I mean, there are certain orchids that are really rooted in the soil. They begin life in the soil, and then clear epiphytes.
And is vanilla in particular a secondary? I mean, it's a separate epiphytic.
Yeah, vanilla is odd because literature sometimes calls it an epiphyte. I don't like that because the seeds always germinate in soil. They live as terrestrials, and they are scrambling vines. The lower part of the vine can die, and the plant effectively continue growing as an epiphyte, but they're terrestrials to begin with. I mean, it's.
Are there many maritime littoral orchids, or do you mean this salt spray? Is that what you think is the basis for the leaflessness?
These leafless ones grow in really hot, dry sun, not so close to the shore, although there are some that are found on dunes, like in Puerto Rico and so forth, back from the seashore. I think it's more just an adaptation to heat and dryness as opposed to some kind of salt tolerance. A lot of them also develop really strong pigmentation. They'll look orange or red. As a probably a natural sunscreen, but
I've seen them on that point. Just an observation that there's an increasing number of data showing that often, even on music sites, tropical forests or islands are not as shady as those on mainland areas.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, the parallel example I gave of the Vandy that has become leafless. I mean, those are epiphytes, so presumably they're also experiencing pretty strong sunny conditions on twigs, branches, and so forth.
Well, I was going to say, are the leafless ones are certainly can, but are the leafed ones also can?
I don't know, actually. I really don't know.
I mean, that's another thing. If they have cam, then there's not a whole lot of advantage photosynthetically, of a broad leaf, because it's going to be succulent compared to the stem, so it's something.
Yeah.
It could be cam in the stem.
It's also interesting, this is a whole other topic we don't have time for, but in that group of vanilla orchids, the subfamily Vanilloidae, maybe of all the orchid subfamilies, there's a higher percentage of mycoheterotrophic orchids, those that have lost their ability to photosynthesize and instead live directly on fungi. So the loss of leaves and even the loss of photosynthetic ability is sort of prevalent within that clade. And I think looking at some of the genetics behind that could be really interesting as well. Well, thank you for your time.